Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar, broadcasting from my home studio. There has been significant news the past few days about COVID-19. First, the number of cases are surging across the country and in Pennsylvania. Yesterday, the State Department of Health reported more than 6,300 cases over the two-day weekend. Pennsylvania now has had about 235,000 positive cases since the virus first appeared last spring. The state is averaging 3,200 new cases a day, a 37% increase over last week's average of about 2,300 a day, and 204% higher than last month's average. Also, biopharmaceutical giant Pfizer announced early testing data shows a 90% success rate in a coronavirus vaccine trial. Finally, President-elect Joe Biden has appointed a coronavirus task force to make recommendations on how to stop the spread of the virus. 8 months into the pandemic, we've learned a lot, but there still are many questions. From time to time, we've had medical professionals on the program to answer your coronavirus questions. Joining us today, he's been with us before, Dr. Gerald Maloney, Chief Medical Officer for Geisinger Hospitals. Dr. Maloney, welcome back to the program.
Morning, Scott. Thank you.
Now, this is an opportunity for you to ask questions about the coronavirus COVID-19. 1-800-729-7532 is the number to call. If you have a question or comment that you would like to email, you can send it to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. So, Dr. Maloney, before we get into answering listeners' questions and some of the questions, things we've learned about the coronavirus over the last 8 months, I want to talk about some of the things I just mentioned. Why do you think the number of cases is increasing so much here in Pennsylvania and across the country?
Scott, I think there's a couple reasons to that. I think primarily people are suffering from what we've come to call COVID fatigue. They're used to living with the virus. It doesn't have as much of an impression on people as it once did. And people are kind of, you know what, I've had it. I'm just going to go about my normal business. We've got that. We've got an increasing number of people who do not, for whatever reason, choose to wear a mask. And then finally, as the weather's been getting cooler, and, you know, fortunately, the past few days, it's not been the case. But as the weather's getting cooler, people are moving indoors, and the indoor environment adds significant burden to the challenges of the virus. And so I think that when you put that all together, I think you've got people trying to return to normal activity when it's really inappropriate to do so. And combined with the other things that I mentioned, I think that that's the recipe for disaster here.
A 204% increase in Pennsylvania from last month. I mean, that's just overwhelming when you think about those kind of numbers. I mean, I know there has been so much attention in the media, and everyone has just been, focused on the election over the past month or so. I wonder if that's had an impact on people, falling into this COVID fatigue thing that you're talking about, that people just aren't paying as much attention.
I think in the days, weeks, and months leading up to the election, I think that the more that we saw and the more that we heard the message of, you know, you don't need to wear a mask, it's optional, you know, you can if you want to, but you don't have to. And more so the fact that, you know, large gatherings close together are okay, you know, in spite of considerable evidence that it's not okay. I think that, you know, when you hear that repeatedly, I think that that begins even in, you know, the most savvy listener, that takes a toll over time, and it gets you to start to question yourself, and it makes it easier for you to take, you know, little breaks in your precautions. So I think that that has had something to do with it. I think that, you know, the statistics that you just mentioned are frightening. And, you know, the fact is that we're seeing more cases in the hospitals now than we did back in March and April, which is something that if you told me in March and April that in November we'd be seeing even more cases, I probably would have, you know, moved to New Zealand or someplace. But I think that the number of positive tests per day is increasing. And I think it's also very important to note that, in contrast to things that have been reported in, you know, in some of the media, the number of cases is not increasing because we have more testing. We're able to find more people who have the virus, but we're not giving them the virus. That's, you know, the analogy has been made that, you know, you would not have any babies being born if it were not for pregnancy tests. So it's the same kind of thing. Yes, are there more testing being done now than there was in March? But that's a good thing. And the fact that we're finding more people is the part that's very alarming, because we now know that there are more people. There's a greater chance that every person that you come into contact with has the virus than there was back in the spring.
One statistic that is a little bit different than the spring is the percentage of people who are dying from the virus is down compared to, say, April or May. Is that because we've learned to treat it better?
Yeah, I believe that it is. I believe that it's because we've learned to treat it better, and I believe that people have been getting into treatment sooner. So in March, April timeframe, even people who knew that they had COVID, people who had had a positive test, were being encouraged, you know, to stay away from everybody, just stay home. And so by the time people got into the hospital, by the time people came to the emergency department, the disease was fairly well advanced. So I think we're getting them into treatment sooner. I think we've learned a lot about the way the virus behaves, which is different than, you know, viruses that we have experience with. And I think that we've been able to identify those signs that, you know, tell us that people are really at risk. And so I think the combination of getting people into treatment sooner, some of the new therapeutics that were not available in the spring, but mostly what we've learned about when you're in the hospital, how do we treat you? How do we avoid putting you on the ventilator? What are the things that we need to do for you and able to help your body fight the virus? Because essentially your body is still the best weapon against the virus.
You mentioned ventilators very early on. That was a real concern, that we would have enough ventilators across the country. And just what you said, that we've learned that you don't always need to put people on ventilators. Is it still the case that only the most the sickest people are in need of ventilators, or that we have found that maybe people don't need ventilators, even if they are really sick and can still be treated?
There's still a number of people who are going to need to be on a ventilator, but what we have found is that we're able to avoid use of ventilators in a number of people. And we've done that in two ways. One is that, you know, traditionally in medicine, when we saw your this thing that we call your pulse oximetry reading, which is a measure of the level of oxygen in your blood that's taken by putting a sensor on your finger or on your forehead. When that level would drop below a certain number, we would feel that you were at risk and you needed to be on a ventilator in order to get that number up if it couldn't be done other ways. We found that people with this virus are sometimes able to tolerate lower pulse oximetry readings than we would have thought appropriate. We've also found that we're able to use higher concentrations of nasal oxygen. So we're able to give higher concentrations of oxygen, you know, in ways that people are familiar with seeing hospitalized patients with a device attached to their nose, blowing in a much higher concentration of oxygen. So we've been able to oxygenate people's blood sometimes as effectively as we can with a ventilator by doing those things. The problem with ventilators is that they are an invasive procedure. It's an invasive process that also exposes folks to risk. And so if we're able to treat you as well without it as we can with it, that's a plus. And so these things, we've learned that we're able to oxygenate you better under certain circumstances if we lay you on your stomach. That's a technique called proning, rather than laying you on your back, which is traditionally the way that when you walked in to see someone in the hospital, they're laying on their back. So we've learned a lot of different maneuvers, different therapeutic measures that we can do that have really proven effective. And again, much of this is learning, you know, kind of on the, you know, kind of on the fly. We're creating some evidence as we go along. But it's looking back over 6 months, we know that some of these things have been very effective.
Dr. Maloney, when we first saw the first cases in this country, well, and in China as well, it was thought to be almost strictly a respiratory illness. that pneumonia was a real problem, and lungs being infected would be, one of the biggest problems and highest potential for being really sick or dying. But over the last 8 months, I don't know if I've, and I'm only just observing, I don't know if I've ever seen a disease that has presented so many different symptoms. I mean, is this unusual that something would present symptoms like diarrhea, loss of sense of smell and taste, heart problems, brain fog, all those kind of things? And those are just some of the things that this presents itself with.
Yeah, this is very unusual. And again, we're still learning about this virus. But if you look at influenza, so you look at the common flu, which again, a mistake that many people made was in assuming that this virus would behave like the flu, that it would burn out at a certain point, that when the weather got nice, it would go away and things like that. But if you look at something like the flu, you can list off a handful or a handful and a half of symptoms and know that everyone's not going to get them. But understand that we can take a third-year medical student and teach him that if people say these three things to you, you need to test for influenza. We thought that was the case originally with the coronavirus, but we know now that that's not the case. We're seeing many people with no respiratory symptoms whatsoever. We're seeing people with symptoms that we really haven't seen before, like loss of taste and smell. We're seeing people with things that are more like traditional viral symptoms, like headache, fever, chills, those kind of things. We still don't have a handle on why it impacts one person with a different symptom complex than another. There are a variety of theories out there, and that'll be one of the interesting things that we learn, I think, over the next few months. But why one person gets respiratory symptoms, gets pneumonia, the other person has headache, can't smell, and has fever and chills is still unclear.
We have a question from Anne. Says, do we know for sure if we can get the virus from touching something like a door handle, for example, that an infected person has touched? Do we know that for sure?
So we have experience now with about 50 million cases of COVID, of coronavirus worldwide. And we don't have strong evidence that touch is a frequently seen source of infection. I don't think that the surface contamination, surface transmission happens as we thought that it would when this first came out. Again, certainly not saying to ignore hygiene, certainly saying not to, ignore cleaning your surfaces and cleaning your hands, but it does not appear that surface-to-person transmission is as common as we would have thought.
So you're saying that person-to-person transmission seems to be the way that it is transmitted the most?
Yeah. So what I'll say to people, when we have a variety of discussions, is that if I can't breathe in what you breathe out, I'm not going to get it from you. And I think that, there are probably some cases out there where you could trace and say, okay, yeah, it must have been a surface. But for the most part, if I want to not get COVID-19, I need to make sure that I can't breathe in what you breathe out.
But that's a little bit different than the flu, though, isn't it? I mean, for example,
we believe that there's more surface.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I'm sorry. We believe that there's more surface transmission with the flu. We believe that handshaking, that touching one's face is really one of the primary means that flu is transmitted. So we believe that hand hygiene is very important in flu. And again, I'm not saying it's not important in COVID-19, but it does not appear that the likelihood, if you cough into your hands and shake my hand and I touch my face, I can get COVID that way, but it appears that I would be more likely to get influenza that way. Now, there's not strong data for that, so I'll caution all the listeners again. Don't think that we can go out and start shaking hands again instead of elbow bumping or whatever we're doing until this is really under control. Let's continue to minimize contact as much as we can.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Smart Talk tomorrow, it's Veterans Day, and we have two segments tomorrow looking at something that having to do with the veterans, two topics having to do with the veterans. One, a book written by a veteran himself about leadership and using the Battle of Gettysburg and decisions made in Gettysburg as examples of leadership skills that can be applied even today. And also an exhibit at the U.S. Army Heritage and Education Center having to do with the first Desert Storm in the early 1990s. That's coming up on tomorrow's program. Right now, we're talking about the COVID-19 coronavirus with Dr. Gerald Maloney, Chief Medical Officer for Geisinger Hospitals. Dr. Maloney will answer your questions about COVID-19. And it's just amazing that 8 months into this, there still are many questions. 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org on Twitter. We are at Smart Talk WITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Dr. Maloney, I did want to ask you about the news yesterday about Pfizer, that early testing of a vaccine, a possible vaccine, shows a 90% success rate. Your thoughts on that? I mean, that this has shown some great, a lot of people are very optimistic about this and has shown great hope that possibly being one of the answers to ending this.
Yeah, so this is very exciting news. And I think that, you know, maybe now there is actually a glimmer of light at the end of the tunnel. But there's a lot that we should know about this. There's a lot that we should understand about this. So 90% effectiveness is great. And if that holds up, that will certainly be really more than we had hoped for. And when I say if that holds up, everyone needs to understand that 90% effectiveness is in a very small group of people. So I believe there are 43,000 people who have received the Pfizer vaccine as volunteers. And of that, a small number got a small number of people tested have, you know, gotten the virus. And so that's where that 90% figure comes from. But again, it's only a small, it is a statistically significant number, and it probably will hold up. But that's one of the things that we need to keep in mind. The other things that we need to keep in mind are that it will take a considerable amount of time for a sufficient number of Americans to be vaccinated with this or with any of the vaccines that will come that will follow this. I saw last night that 25 million doses will be released very shortly if the FDA approves. But those 25 million doses will be essentially not just for the United States, they will be worldwide. So by the time we get enough doses produced that everyone gets two doses, because the Pfizer vaccine is going to require a second dose as well. So it's a two-shot process. That'll take time. The other thing that's interesting about this vaccine is that it needs to be kept ultra cold. So it needs to be shipped and stored at negative 70 degrees Celsius, which is negative 94 degrees. So 94 degrees below zero Fahrenheit is the temperature that you need to be able to maintain in a truck to deliver this, that you need to be able to maintain in a clinic until the vaccine is given. And that's creating a significant challenge as well. You know, we're up to the challenge. There are freezers being built. There are freezers. You know, people have these freezers already for a variety of purposes. Trucks are being outfitted that can do this. Dry ice will be employed. But again, it's not going to be as easy as it may have sounded when you heard the news yesterday on the radio. But still, it is something that is finally a glimmer of hope that we may actually be able to get this under control.
Also, yesterday, President-elect Joe Biden appointed a coronavirus task force to make recommendations, 13 members to that task force. As a physician, as a medical professional, what kind of recommendations would you have if you were a member of this task force, and what would you like to see come out of this task force?
So, I mean, the initial recommendations are actually simple because, you know, I said before that we've learned a lot since this started. Some of it was new knowledge. We've also confirmed a lot of what we thought in the first place, and that is that the best thing is prevention. So it's better to prevent people from getting sick than it is to let them get sick and then, you know, get them to recover one way or another. And so the standards still have to be the things that we knew about in March, and that's the masking, the social distancing, and the hygiene. So we still need to maintain that. We still need to figure out how to get at least 95% of the people to wear a mask when they're around any other person. And then we can, you know, branch out into the other things, how we get the vaccine administered and things like that. But as of right now, if you had your choice between receiving the virus and wearing a mask, wearing a mask right now is probably more effective than the vaccine. And the reason why I say that is because it takes, we believe that it's going to take about a month for you to build up immunity after you get the shot. And so during that month, you would still be susceptible. So you're still protected from the minute you put the mask on. So that's still a better way to do it. But what else would I like to see? I'd like to see an effective, a good, clear strategy for, you know, rolling out the vaccine. But I think that until and unless we're able to get everybody masked, that has to be the first step. If we're going to bring the virus under control, it still has to be masking and social distancing, especially now as we head into the holidays.
We have a question from Joan. Says, there are a percentage of us who are experiencing lingering symptoms, long haulers. What is it that we know about treating this group? Are there clinics studying these people? What is a long hauler?
Yeah, so a long hauler is someone, and Joan, thanks for that question, Joan. And Joan said it, you know, it's the lingering effects afterwards. Now, these can be any number of things. In the severe cases, we see people who had no respiratory, no lung conditions, acquired COVID-19, and now they continue on oxygen. They continue to be unable to climb a flight of steps. We've heard about younger people getting, you know, some heart manifestations and things like that. But we're seeing a significant number of people who get daily headaches. We're seeing a significant number of people who lost taste and smell, and that continues on. We're seeing a number of people who, you know, one of their symptoms was a profound fatigue, you know, really an effort to get through the day. And we're seeing that linger. These things are all being studied. And again, these are all things that we really haven't seen before. We've seen some things like this, but not on as great an extent. And I think that I haven't seen data to support what I'm about to say, but in my experience, people would get over other viral infections and be back to their pre-viral normal a lot quicker than is happening with COVID-19. And we don't have a clear explanation for that right now, but there's a lot of interest in studying that.
Two symptoms that some people have shown, and I guess this would fit under the long haul category, is brain fog and heart problems. Can you talk about those two?
Yes. Again, seeing quite a bit. I think we're seeing more, again, in my experience, seeing more of the brain fog, the people who just, you know, it's not a confusion in the sense that you would look at somebody who has dementia or something like that. But it's just that, boy, there's something about it. I'm just not clear. I hear what you're saying, but yet it's taken an extra second or two for it to register. I know what I want to say, but I have to, you know, really make an effort to get it to come out the way that I want to. So, you know, again, kind of like the person we say in a fog, the way that I compare that to is sometimes when you first wake up from a deep sleep and it takes you a little bit of time to really understand what's going on. It's you know, kind of like that. Again, there's no clear theory as to why that is, and there's certainly no clear theory as to how to clear it up other than time. I will say that the cases that I'm personally familiar with do seem to clear over time, but even then, the time can be somewhat variable. The heart conditions also, I mean, we see heart conditions that are lasting just like we see lung conditions that are lasting. And I think that to a certain extent, that's because there's actual damage to the heart muscle itself or the actual lung tissue caused by the virus, that when the virus is gone and you're cured, the damage has remained. Let's think of, I have a house and a tornado comes through. The tornado's now gone. It's perfectly calm. The sun is shining, but the roof is still off my house. So those are the situations that we're being left with. Again, a lot of interest, a lot of research going on, but nothing clear at this point.
We have a question from Joe, and I don't know whether you could answer this, Dr. Maloney, or maybe it's best answered by the Department of Health, but wants to know why there are travel restrictions. There were travel restrictions just announced for New Jersey and other adjacent states. What exactly are we supposed to assess for safety precautions? Why call out an entire state? Why not say what areas of a state need more caution and preventative measures, like Pennsylvania, New Jersey is a diverse state? What do you think about that? I mean, is calling it, saying that it's not safe to travel to an entire state, is that too big? And I guess the big question there for Joe is, how are we to assess what's safe and what's not?
Yeah. So here's the theory behind the behind that sort of restriction. The theory is that, again, I said a couple minutes ago that I can only get it from somebody who has it, right? If I can't breathe in what somebody who has COVID breathes out, then I'm not going to get it. We look at the prevalence in the community. We look at the likelihood that every person that we see on the street is going to be infected. And when you look at community spread, which is something that we're experiencing right now in Pennsylvania to a much greater extent than we did in the spring. When you look at community spread, that's, again, just the way that it travels, you know, down your street in your neighborhood without anything, you know, without having to be in the hospital or anything, or having to go into what, you know, what you think is a high risk situation. So you've essentially stayed home. You've only gone to the grocery store, and here you are having it. And how did that happen? You know, gee, I don't know. So the thought is that if we have areas where the likelihood of a person that we meet being infected with COVID is extremely high, that then would put us at risk, you know, for travel there. And these travel bans and travel restrictions have been in place really since the spring. I think that when, you know, when New York State and New York City was under siege in the spring, there was a lot of talk about that. There were some episodes in the Poconos where people were trashing cars because they had New York license plates because they felt that they were a threat. I think that if you were to go to New Jersey, if you understand that contact with other people needs to be minimized just as it is in Pennsylvania, and if you're wearing your mask and the people you come in contact with are wearing your mask and you're 6 feet apart, I don't think there's anything, you know, exceptionally dangerous about that. But the hope is that if we can keep a population where there's a high prevalence of COVID-19, if we can keep that population somewhat contained, that they won't, you know, spread out and allow further spread. This is in the beginning, in February, March, when we were talking about stopping airline flights from China and things like that. It's the same concept. I think that now, so many different areas have the high degree of community spread that it may not be helpful to have these travel restrictions in place, but certainly they will remain in place as long as there's some thought that, you know, they could somehow slow the spread.
If you're just tuning in, our guest today is Dr. Joe Maloney. He's the chief medical officer of Geisinger Hospitals, answering your coronavirus questions. This is a great opportunity. If you have a question, have had a question about COVID-19 for some time, give us a call. 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. I have to say that I was not aware, I had not heard those stories of cars with New York license plates being trashed in the Poconos. One of the things that this pandemic has done is sometimes turn people against one another. And in a lot of ways, it's become political. I guess this goes back to my original question of why we're seeing cases increases, and some people take it seriously and others don't.
You know, Scott, I do think the fact that the virus is still with us to the extent that it is has very much to do with the fact that masking was made a political issue. You know, masking has never been a political issue. Masking has been a public health measure. And I'm fascinated still when I see people on the TV news saying, well, it should be my choice and, you know, it's unconstitutional and I have my rights and things like that. But, I mean, traditionally in the United States, my right to do anything has been limited by the impact it may have on someone else. So there's always been a saying that my right to swing my fist ends at your nose, right? I have the right to swing my fist. I have the right to free speech, but I don't have the right to free speech when it's detrimental to, you know, the reputation of another person and things like that. And I think that we need to look at that in terms of masking too. So the mask that I wear is for your protection. If I want to be cavalier and say I trust my own immune system or whatever I want to say, that's fine. But understand that if I'm breathing it out and I'm coming close enough to you that you can breathe it in, I'm putting you at risk. I kind of think about, you know, those arguments as, you know, well, you can't make me do something. And I think, well, we require you to wear a seatbelt. We require you to drive on the right side of the road. We require you to not drink before driving. We require you to be careful with fire and chemicals and things like that. I think as a public health measure, you know, masking and social distancing should be given the same respect as all those other things that are meant to protect the people.
We have another question here. The Food and Drug Administration has granted emergency authorization of a COVID-19 treatment made by the American pharmaceutical company Eli Lilly. Eli Lilly said that its treatment called, and I'll see if I can pronounce this correctly, bamlanivimab, should be administered as soon as possible after a positive test and within 10 days of developing symptoms. Are you familiar with that treatment, Dr. Maloney?
Yes, slightly. So this is another, this is an anti, an antibody infusion, much similar to what President Trump received, the antibody cocktail that President Trump received at Walter Reed. His was a product made by a company called Regeneron, but I understand that the Lilly product is similar to that. It did get the EUA, the emergency authorization for the FDA, I think just yesterday, and that is true. It should be given. It's not actually for hospitalized people. It's to try to keep people out of the hospital. We're looking into now ways to get that into high-risk people because, again, it's not an infinite supply. So as far as, you know, giving it to everyone as soon as they test positive, I mean, that is the ideal way that we should do it. But right now, if we can get it into the people that are high-risk for deterioration, that'll be helpful. Again, I want to caution everybody that treatments are great, but, you know, I still go back to Ben Franklin, an ounce of prevention is better than a pound of cure. But this is, this again should be significant for some people in high risk populations like those with pre-existing conditions.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar.
For a deeper look at the changing tide of healthcare, check out WITF's Transforming Health at transforminghealth.org, a partnership of WITF, WellSpan Health, and Capital Blue Cross.
Welcome back to Smart Talk. Our guest today is Dr. Gerald Maloney. He's Chief Medical Officer for Geisinger Hospitals. Answering your coronavirus questions, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Phone number one more time, 1-800-729-7532. I encourage you, if you want to make a phone call, to do that soon, because we only have about 15 minutes left in the program. Dr. Maloney, something I've been curious about during this whole pandemic, you were just talking about getting information on this new treatment. Obviously, medical professionals like yourself go through medical school, you learn on the job, that kind of thing. But with a situation like this, where there is a new illness and that we are learning so much, it seems, you know, sometimes almost daily about it. Where do hospitals like yourselves, doctors, other medical professionals, where do you get your guidance on how to treat this this illness? I mean, is it a universal thing that everyone is informed that, okay, here's what we think works, why don't you try this, here are some treatments you can use? How do you go about that?
So one of the hallmarks of the scientific method is the sharing of results, and so there are a lot of different avenues by which we share our results. So if a hospital in California does a small study and finds something promising, I mean, that'll be reported in the medical literature, you know, almost instantly these days, the way that we don't even have to wait for things to come into print. We rely to a great extent, actually, on the CDC. We rely to a great extent on the Pennsylvania Department of Health. They are both great sources of information and guidance for us throughout this entire thing. We also rely on our own physicians, because our own physicians will sometimes make an observation that will lead to a study, that will lead to a result, that will lead to a recommendation. These have been happening much faster now than ever before. And I think that one of the things that I like to caution people about is that when we find something today that goes against something that we thought was the case in July, that doesn't mean that any of this is made up. So people will say, oh, you know, you're telling us something completely different than July. I mean, everything can't be right. And it's like, no, but this is in a state of evolution, and we try to learn more about things as we go along. But suffice it to say that I think for the public, I think that you need to pay attention to the things that you see on the news media for certain. But you need to have a source that you can trust, whether it's your family physician or, you know, organizations like mine will have a website that the public can access that has, information, new information, frequently asked questions, things like that, because it can be an awful lot to digest even for a physician. So for someone without medical training, it can be absolutely overwhelming.
But do you, as the chief medical officer for Geisinger, do you make the final decision as to, okay, here's what we're going to do?
No, we have a group of people that do that. So we have infectious disease specialists. We have an epidemiologist. We have, you know, a variety of specialties that are involved in things like this. We participate in a group with Dr. Levine, the Secretary of Health, that meets every 2 weeks. That includes representatives from all the major health systems in Pennsylvania. So we always have our antennas up, so to speak, for new information. But one of the things that we do when we hear a piece of new information is we try to validate it and make sure that the information behind it is scientifically sound. And, you know, then we'll have discussions internally. So I may say that from my standpoint, this sounds good. But I may have a cardiologist say, well, that doesn't sound good to me because here's why. And so there's a constant re-evaluation and evaluation and re-evaluation of all the information that comes out on a daily basis to try to ensure that we're only going to do things that are effective but are also going to be safe.
Something that you said a few minutes ago is significant when you said that the things we thought we knew in July may be different now. I think that's one of the problems that we have with mask wearing, is that when this first started, there was some question as to whether masks worked from the federal government. And then when we learned a short time, it didn't take long, that mask wearing would be one of the ways to prevent it, you had a lot of people pointing to it and saying, well, we were told that masks didn't work. You agree with that?
Yeah, I mean, that's probably the best example. I think that's the classic example of how thinking has evolved over the course of this illness. So back in February, people were showing up. I remember seeing pictures of celebrities getting off airplanes with, you know, wearing masks, and we thought they were crazy. And then data started to come in from the countries that had experienced the virus before we did. So from China, from Korea. And we saw that in those areas, you know, one of the things that they did was they mandated masking. And again, they have the ability to mandate things much stronger than we do. They mandated masking, and there didn't seem to be much else done, and yet their numbers came down. Now, at the time, there were people who thought, well, maybe that's the natural course of the virus, and it's just burning out. But by looking at the data that those countries were producing, it appeared that there was more to it than that. At the same time, you learn more about the virus itself and how it behaves in the air. And I mean, that's a whole, you know, that's another story completely. But you go from that to saying, okay, well, maybe we should wear masks. And then you find out that if you wear a mask, it might not protect you, but it might protect the other person. So now we ask everybody to wear a mask. Then you find out that there's different grades of mask. And if I can, you know, if I can breathe through the mask, it's not going to be as protective as if, you know, I can't feel my breath coming out the other side. And then we look at masks that, oh, well, these masks actually have filters in them that filter small particles like viruses, and maybe they'll be more effective. And so that's how we go along the line. But the first inkling of that actually came from the countries where the virus had spread originally. And those countries did get it under control a lot quicker than we did because of, you know, because of exactly that.
Let's take a phone call from Bonnie in Harrisburg. Bonnie, you're on the air.
Yes, thank you. I have a question. My husband and I are exercisers. Now, we have discontinued going to Planet Fitness. We're members there. But we do still walk on nature trails, which has been our habit for a long time, for about an hour at a time. And we're wondering, we don't wear our masks when we're on the nature trails, but we carry them with us. And if we see a group or something, you know, we put them on, like ahead of us, we'll put them on. Or we wondered about people riding by on their bicycles, because on some of the nature trails, like at Veterans Park, they allow bicyclers. And if they ride by and they're breathing heavy, do we have to be concerned? Or if someone, a runner, comes by and they're breathing heavy, should we be wearing our masks at that point? You know, just how?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I actually get asked that, some variation of that question a lot. And so one of the other pieces of advice that we've given for many months that we're now changing a little bit is how close and for how long. So we still think that 6 feet is the optimal distance. So again, if a runner or a biker passes, you know, closer than 6 feet to you, is that an issue? So that's one thing. But the other thing is how much time is involved, how much time before, you know, is really considered an exposure. And we said for the longest time that it was 15 minutes. So we felt that unless I was close within 6 feet of you for longer than 15 minutes, that was protective. We now know, or we now strongly suspect, that 15 minutes doesn't have to be at one time. That 15 minutes can be additive over the course of a day, so that if, you know, I'm with somebody for 1 minute 15 times, that, you know, can add up to the 15 minutes. But if you think about the person riding past you on the bike or running past you, the amount of time that they're actually within 6 feet of you is probably just a few seconds. So I don't think that there's significant chance of acquiring the virus, you know, in that way, from a jogger going past you or a bicyclist going past you. Having said that, it would not hurt you to, when you see them coming, to put your own mask on, because I do think that your own mask gives you some protection, even though we say it primarily is protect the other person. But I don't think that I would not encourage you to stop going. And the other thing, part about that is you're outside too, right? So outside is safer than inside. So I would not hesitate to tell you to continue, you know, walking on the nature trail just as you are now. I would commend you for being that concerned about others that you carry your mask with you and put them on when you're coming close to someone.
Thank you very much for the call, Bonnie. And here's a question, Dr. Maloney, that a lot of people have going into the holidays. Marcia asked, we have a limited, very small family gathering at Thanksgiving. Our two daughters and their spouses, we're all following good practices and we'll be wearing masks. We are hosting, and my husband and I are both seniors with no underlying health conditions. The question she's asking is around mealtime. This is when the masks come off. We can't sit 6 feet apart at the table. Would you recommend send a table further away or TV trays placed around an appropriate distance? What's the best way to stay safe while we're eating?
This is the most pertinent question now, as we've got Thanksgiving just coming up in a couple of weeks, because, you know, obviously no one wants to appear antisocial to your family, especially when it's family that you haven't seen in a while. But the fact that you haven't seen them in a while essentially makes them strangers. And one of the reasons why we believe that we're in the problem that we're in now is because people have become too complacent around family members and around coworkers. So that if I see someone at work every day, you know, they must be okay. So therefore, we can go have a cup of coffee without having our mask on. But other than people who live in your immediate household, anyone else is going to pose a risk. That risk is greater now, too, because one of the other things we've learned over the past couple months, you know, we believed in the beginning that you couldn't get it from anybody unless they were sick. We now know that people may not be sick and still be able to give it to you, or that people may have a symptom that they don't recognize because of the things that we mentioned a couple minutes ago about how, you know, strange the symptom complex is with this. So if your daughter's coming from out of town, and you haven't seen her in a while, she doesn't live in your house, she's essentially a stranger, and you have risk of getting the virus from her. Now, how do you minimize that? So certainly to wear the masks when possible. The other part of it is distance. So if you're able to, you know, somehow rig up dinner so that you're 6 feet apart, that's great. The other thing is ventilation. So if you can have, you know, we don't know what the weather will be like on Thanksgiving Day, but if you can have windows open, if you can have doors open, if you could potentially be, you know, in a room with a lot of windows that you can have open, that's helpful as well. That's protective as well. So I think that, you know, if you can maintain your distance as best possible, have your dinner, and then get the masks back on for the after dinner conversation, you know, hopefully everything will be okay. But the fact is that the virus doesn't respect our family ties. So the virus doesn't care whether you're my first cousin or whether you're my sister or whether you're a complete stranger. The virus just knows that I'm close enough where I can breathe in what you've breathed out.
I have another question asked. How can you find a doctor with COVID experience? A friend had horrible blood pressure 8 months after COVID. Gives the blood pressure at 210 over 103. And the doctor was more concerned that she see a hematologist because her veins were like steel. Hematologist was very casual about her condition. A nurse said it was a dangerous situation. Not asking you to make a diagnosis, but what do you think about that?
Yeah, that's one of the other things that we've seen is that some, even some medical professionals are so focused on COVID that they don't want to consider anything else. I mean, I'd say that you need to evaluate the relationship that you have with your primary physician. Your primary physician should be your source of guidance in all these things. And, you know, again, without making a diagnosis, you know, let me say that if your blood pressure is out of control, I don't think that we control blood pressure in someone who may have gotten it because, you know, it may have shown up after COVID than we would in somebody who had never had COVID. So the same blood pressure medicines, you know, should still work. The same processes should still work. If you at any time think that your physician isn't hearing you, that your physician is, you know, more focused on, you know, whether you do or don't or did have COVID than on the task at hand, then it may be time for a frank conversation with him or her.
Another question, is it safe to get care for my other medical conditions during this time?
Absolutely. The hospitals are doing a tremendous amount of work in ensuring safety. One of the things that we saw early on, and we're still seeing to a certain extent, is the amount of people doing themselves harm by postponing their care. So the amount of people who, you know, were not coming for their routine mammogram, the amount of people who, when sick, would not come to the emergency room, the amount of people who would notice, you know, a strange looking lump or a strange looking sore and would not go to see about it because they were concerned about getting COVID. You're probably putting yourself at a greater risk than with COVID. But the hospitals are doing a tremendous job to make sure that the traffic through them is kept as low as it can be. Many hospitals have reinstituted severe visitation restrictions and other things to make sure that the number of people in any one area does not exceed the recommendation. Some of them seem pretty harsh. We ask sometimes people to sit outside in their car and we'll call you when it's time to come in. But if you've got a medical condition, if you've got a medical concern, absolutely get it looked at.
My son just arrived in South Korea 2 days ago for an extended training program. He was ushered off the plane into a testing site, then to a government hotel facility for mandatory quarantine, basically a lockdown for 14 days. Can't leave the room. Can we even lower or ever lower numbers here in this country if we don't do something similar?
Well, I mean, I think it's a two-part question, really. So the first part is, can we do anything to lower our numbers without doing something as strict as that? And the answer is yes. The normal things that if 95% of us would wear a mask, this fact was in the news last week, if 95% of us would wear a mask, it would save 100,000 lives by New Year's. And that's true. So if we were to wear masks, if we were to distance, if we were to do all the things that we've been talking about, that will get our numbers down significantly. If we bring someone in from a situation, so when he comes back from Korea, are we going to do the same thing? No. Should we? You know, we can debate that. But suffice it to say that if he's as cautious as we've been talking about, he would not put us at greater risk. So we don't have to be as draconian about some of the measures if everyone would just cooperate and do their part.
Dr. Maloney, I want to thank you very much for being with us today. In about the 30 seconds or less, a message for those listening today and how to prevent this?
If you want to help your healthcare heroes, people call me and say, oh, what can we do for the people in the hospital? What can we give you? Can we bring them lunch? No, wear your mask. If you want to help your healthcare heroes, make sure that they don't have to take care of as many COVID patients as they are taking care of now.
Dr. Gerald Maloney, Chief Medical Officer for Geisinger Hospitals. Dr. Maloney, thank you very much once again for being with us today.
Thank you, Scott.
Tomorrow is Veterans Day. Be sure to tune in.